We are in Iyov Perek Chav Zayin, Job chapter 27. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, it's page 1654. And I hope everybody did have a good break, a chance to maybe get some of the pessimism out of their system. And now we reintroduce it. This is, as I noted last time, Iyov's first final speech. It's his first closing address. The second closing address will be chapters 29 to 31. Chapter 27, which we started last time, remember, just framework, because we've been out of it for a couple of weeks. We had the speeches by the visitors. We had a third round of speeches in which first Eliphaz spoke, Job responded. Bildad spoke very, very briefly. Job responded. There was no speech from Zophar. After Job's response to Bildad, then we launched into chapters 27 and 28, which are not presented as a response at all, but rather, chapter 27 began with Vayosef Iyov Seit Mishalo. Job just continued to, or added to what he had been doing, Seit Mishalo, picking up his mashal. I actually had occasion to read the Dan Mikra's introduction to Mishle last week. Different purpose. And he talks about the different meanings of the word mashal. But mashal tends to be educational. There are different types of mishalim, and the word mashal is used in Tanakh in different ways. Sometimes it's prophecy, sometimes it's just a wise saying. He enumerates there are four or five different uses of the word mashal, but it's always meant to be something educational. So Job is now going to teach his visitors, the crowd, whoever it is that he's addressing here. And in chapter 27, he reiterates that which he has said earlier. He says, those who disagree with me... Sorry?
In Kaf Aleph, in 21,
yeah.
He was talking
about how he got right. But he says, those who disagree with me, those who want to flatter God, they're not going to prosper. In fact, God is going to punish people who flatter him with lies. That was what he had said. That's what he's going to say in 27. He has said it before. He said, I will maintain my righteousness. And then in Perek Chavchet, in chapter 28, that's when things are really going to go off the rails, in the sense that he's going to present something which at face value doesn't have anything to do with what came before. And of course, part of our job is going to be to figure out, what's it doing here? But we did the opening six sentences from Perek Chav Zayin, from chapter 27. We did those last time. And that was the statement of Job, I am just and I will never give in. And he began, you will recall, by swearing by God who has warped his judgment. Right? You remember that we noted that? Does that at all ring a bell? Please? Tell me it does. He swears by the God who has warped his judgment, and we said swearing by God is usually a statement of loyalty. It shows that you do respect God, and he swears by God who has warped his judgment, one page 1655. Which in somebody else's mouth would be seen as a hostile statement. God who has warped my judgment is a bad thing. And for Job, frankly, it's hostile as well, leading Dan Mikra to say this is sarcastic. But another way you could read it is simply that, yes, God has warped my judgment, and yes, I'm loyal to God. Both of these are true. Right? Like the line that we've talked about before, Hein yikteleini lo ayachel, he's going to kill me and I'm still going to long for him. That's okay. We have a very complex relationship, God and me. That's a way to look at it. And he said, in sentences 4 and 5, im tedaberna sfatai avla, he says, I am never going to speak falsely. I'm never going to say something that is cunning. I will retain my state of being a tam, lo asir tumati mimeni. I will never abandon my state of being tam, of being simple, of being with God. And finally, in Pasuk Vav, in sentence 6, he said, Bitzidkati hechazakti. I maintain my righteousness, velo arpeha, and I am never letting it go. This is who I am. I am loyal to God, and I am righteous. That's what he said in the opening six sentences of chapter 27. Please keep in mind, in particular, sentence 6. When he says, "Bitzidkati hechezakti," I hold on to my righteousness. That's going to matter a great deal when we get to chapter 28. So just make sure that you remember that line. So we are up to sentences 7 to 10. In which he continues his statement of his own righteousness and criticism of the visitors. Okay, are we now somewhat oriented to where we are? I rushed through the orientation a little bit. I hope that we have some sense of where we are. And the theme in this next section, sentences 7 to 10, is going to be a criticism of those other people who he claims are flattering God. That's the overall statement that we're going to see here. If you take a look at source number 4, I gave you an intro to it from Da'at Mikra. He says, "Hosif ledaber aleihem b'signonam shelahem." He spoke to them in their style. In other words, what's coming here is going to be a statement to the visitors using their approach. He's going to threaten them with all of the suffering, with all of the punishments that are anticipated to befall the wicked. He says, that's going to happen to you. Using the same language that they did in their speeches. So what he's saying is that God is going to strike them. They said that wicked people get hit with X, Y, and Z. That's what's going to happen to them. They're going to be hit with X, Y, and Z. That's the statement. So take a look at how he does it. Pasuk Zion, sentence 7. Yehi cherasha oivi umiskomemi cheaval. May my enemy be like the wicked one. Meaning, may God do to my enemies as he does to the wicked. That should befall them. There are other ways to take it. Rashi, Malbim, Mitzvah, David. But that's a basic take on the sentence. He's saying, they deserve what happens to the wicked. May that be what God brings upon them. Umitkomami. Those who rise up against me, ke'aval, like the aval. Aval is often a crooked person, a bad person. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it means a young person. We've seen that also. But here he's saying that that they should have the fate of the wicked. Ki ma tikvas chaneif ki yivtza. Because what hope is there for the chaneif? What have we said a chaneif is? Sorry? So flatterer is a broad term for chaneif. Often in this book it has just meant someone who does bad things, but here I think I'm with Shana that I would use the more narrow definition, because that's what he's talking about. He says they are flatterers. They seek to satisfy God with flattery for him. So what hope should they have? And note the word tikva, which you've seen over and over again in this book. If we actually manage to finish this book with a week or two to go before the end of the year, I'd love to spend some time talking about certain key words that show up throughout the book, and tikva is definitely one of them. So that's an if. Yeah. Oh, well, that's the thing. This is a central word in the book for the person who completely lacks it. Yes. So he says, what tikva, what hope should there be for the flatterer? Ki yivtza. Yivtza, he pursues betza. Betza is profit. Right? When Yehuda says, why should we kill Yosef? Ma betza ki narog es achinu. What profit, what gain will we have? So he says, what hope is there for this person when he pursues betza, when he pursues profit? Ki yeshel eloka nafsho. When God will cast down his life, God is going to punish him. Yeshel, like vinashal, is one explanation. There are others as well. But he has nothing to hope for if he's going to try to do this. Pasuk Tet, sentence 9. Hatzaka so yishmakel. Is God going to hear him when he cries out? Ki savo alav tzara. When troubles come upon him, you think God's going to help him? you visitors, right? Because really, he's speaking in the third person, but he's really speaking in the second person, right? He's speaking about it as though the people who rise up against him are some third party who's not in the room. But it's not. It's all those people who he has sitting in front of him who have been telling him how bad he is. And he says, you think that God's going to be on your side? You think when you're in trouble, God's going to help you? Im al shakai yis anag. Will he find oneg? Will he find pleasure with God? Yikra eloka b'chol eis. You think he can call out to God at any time and God is going to hear him? Now note that he has also borrowed a phrase here. This is very clever. And it's the sort of thing that we miss because we read the book too slowly. You have to read it more quickly and then you'll remember earlier verses. Jump back, please, to chapter 22, sentence 26. And tell me what you see. This one, so I can tell you the page. So it's the top of page 1651.
Yes, in the first one, it's a statement. It's sure, and here it is casting doubt eyes.
Well, let me just read it out to make sure that everyone sees what I'm seeing here. Ki az al shakai tit anag. Then you will have pleasure with God. That's a promise there. This is what will happen to you. And in our chapter, Job says, im al shakai yit anag. Will he have pleasure with God? Now, who was speaking in the earlier iteration, in chapter 22? Who was the author of that statement? Who promised pleasure with God? Eliphaz. Precisely. Eliphaz said, if you follow my prescription, right, take one pill a day. No, if you follow my prescription, if you do what I'm telling you to do, you will have pleasure with God. And Job is coming back and saying, who are you kidding? Do you think that if you say what you say and you take the approach that you take, you think you will have pleasure with God? It's a direct answer to Eliphaz. He's saying, you're kidding. It's not true. Your promises are false. They're not going to come true. That's his statement. He says, God is not going to provide you with what you see. You're not getting what you think you're getting by pursuing this approach. That's the statement. I realized that I actually jumped on the notes. For some reason I read you from source number 4 when I meant to read you from source number 1. Oops. Four is still true. And it's even true of this section, but what I wanted was source number 1, where Dat Mikra makes the statement about what Job is saying here in these verses that we just read. Hu onesh me ein cheto. This, what Job is describing is going to happen to the wicked person, is a punishment that suits his crime. Hu diber lelokim divrei chanufa. She'inam ruyim lehishama lefanav. He, meaning the visitors, speak flatteringly of God. They say nice things, or things that they think are nice, but things that are not true. Lefichach lo tishama. So, therefore, his cry will not be heard. In other words, what Job is saying is, it's measure for measure. Why won't God hear them? Because they spoke things that are not worthy of being heard. They said things about God that aren't true. Therefore, God isn't going to listen when they cry out. You follow? That's what Dat Mikra sees in this section. I think it's very sharp and very accurate. And so, what he says to them is, you're not going to get rewarded for taking this approach. And Rashi sees an additional layer. You're not going to convince me to take your approach. If you take a look at source number 2, Rashi says, Lama ehyeh rasha v'gazlan? Why should I be a thief? Why should I be wicked? Maso voshal rasha gozel mamon? What happens for him in the end? God isn't going to help him. And I'm not going to be like you. I'm not going to be like those people who are visiting me and making these statements. So that's what we're getting in this section here in chapter 27. He turns to them and says, there's no profit in being like you. The things you promised, like Eliphaz promised in chapter 22, are not going to come true. So therefore, don't try to convince me. It's not going to work. Yes?
Well, isn't this someone subjective because it's really an ideal faith, right? Those people are not necessarily
lying. It's what they believe. No, I believe that.
So,
he's not saying, why is he saying that they are lying? They're not. This is what they believe.
Right.
So it's a question of faith, and it's subjective. It's not objective.
Is it? Is it a subject? Is Job making subjective statements? Does he believe that what he's saying is subjective?
Can't believe. No. How could he believe when such terrible things are happening to him?
Yeah, but he's blaming the other, his friends as being disbelievers, but they aren't.
Right. See what Job believes.
You don't believe this, and you're saying it.
Well, what Job believes is that he's making empirical statements. Job believes that you can look at the data. The data meaning the set of things that happen to human beings, definitely including him, and come to an unassailable conclusion. And as far as he's concerned, his visitors believe what he believes, but they're afraid to say so.
Right. So he's making a judgment call.
Oh, you bet. I mean, Job is as judgmental as you're going to find in Tanakh. Absolutely, 100%. Frankly, it's a little bit understandable.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. What he's gone through, I don't.
Feeling that way. I'm just making a statement that they may not necessarily be what he thinks they are.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. I mean, assuming that they are sincere.
Yeah.
Right? Assuming that they are sincere, from their standpoint, you know, this goes back to the question that we asked in the beginning of the second round of speeches, when they started talking about how wicked people suffer. And we asked the question of, do they really believe that this is true? That bad things happen to bad people in response to their bad deeds? And we said that you could read it that way. That was Newsom's argument, is that there are, you know, people do have a belief that this is the way the world works, and you can show them, as Job does, all sorts of other occurrences, things that don't fit their pattern, and their answer will be, that's an anomaly, that requires explanation, but it doesn't defeat my general view of how the world works. Because we form narratives, that's what we do. We make sense of the world around us, we look for patterns, and we identify them. That's not only a function of this search and this book subject. That's true in general in life. The human brain is designed to look for patterns. Right, the evolutionary biologists will tell you it's about being a good hunter and surviving in the wilderness and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, like, when you hear people talk about, you know, what they consider to be crazy, unbelievable coincidences, and you start to break them down and analyze them, often the answer is their brain is making a pattern because it helps them to make sense of the world that way. But when looked at logically and objectively, it's not really there. Right. Well, that's a funny thing, right? The suggestion is that not only do people believe in this narrative because it's a narrative they've constructed, but because they want to believe in the narrative because it makes me feel good. The problem is that it doesn't make someone like Job feel good. Because once the subject of our discussion is getting hit, he doesn't want to believe that bad people suffer. He wants to believe that good people suffer. He'd rather be good and be justified in complaining rather than believe that there's order in the universe. Although I shouldn't say that. That's not entirely true. There is a level of comfort also for the person who's able to say, oh, that's why God did this to me. To the point where people may look for something and find something that isn't even there in themselves because they'd rather have meaning than justification. So that's also to be said.
But don't some good people who don't understand or accept their suffering empathize with not good people who are suffering?
So now you're asking sort of the next level of question, which is, let's say the friends, visitors, whatever we want to call them, believe that wicked people suffer and that Job is suffering and therefore Job must be wicked, right? Which is not really a logical conclusion, but nonetheless that seems to be what they're drawing. Let them structure it differently. They believe that only wicked people suffer and Job is suffering, therefore Job must be wicked. Wouldn't a possible next step still be for them to empathize and for them to feel bad for him and them to say, you know, we feel terrible that you're suffering this way? And the answer, I think, is that that's what Eliphaz tried to do in the beginning of the book. Eliphaz's opening speeches did not insult Job, did not say, Job, you're a bad man. He did make a recommendation, right? He was a stereotypical male, right? faced with the problem. Job is miserable and angry and so on. This is terribly sexist, but it's what they say. That instead of being sympathetic and just listening, he says, I'm going to provide you with a solution. Here's what you need to do. And Job responds bitterly to that. And Job says to him, you know, all I wanted was empathy. All I wanted was for you to listen to me and to be close, and that was all I wanted. I didn't need your prescriptions. But yes, you know, there is certainly the possibility of empathizing, but the visitors can't separate that from tovacha. They can't separate that from rebuke. They think they're helping him by speaking to him this way while he's in the middle of his suffering. That's what I see here. So Job says to them, you don't gain by wickedly flattering God, and I would never want to be like you. He says, I would never want to do the things you do, to take the position that you take. And that brings us now to the latter half of this chapter. Starting with chapter 27, sentence 11. If you flipped the page before to see the earlier verse, you want to go back to page 1655. And Job says here, God is going to crush the wicked people. What's particularly fascinating to me is that the descriptions of crushing of the wicked that he brings to the table are the descriptions of what happened to him. Even though he does not believe himself to be wicked. But what he's going to do is say, those things that happened to me, those are what happened to the wicked people. Chapter 27, sentence 11. He says, I am going to show you, ore, like Torah, right, to teach. I am going to teach you the ways of God. Asher im shakai, lo achachid. That which is with God, I will not conceal. I'm going to teach you the way that God works. And so he says, sentence 12. Hey, natem kulchem chazisem. All of you have seen this. V'lamaze hevel tehebalu. Why is it that you speak empty things? Meaning you've seen what happens to bad people. You've seen wicked people suffer. Or alternatively, you've claimed that wicked people suffer. You've claimed it with your visions from earlier in the book. So why is it that you are going to produce emptiness and futility? Zechelek Adam Rasha in Kael. He says, I'm going to show you what happens to wicked people with God. V'nachlas aritzim mishakai yikachu. I'm going to show you what happens to tyrants. I'm going to show you what they get from God. Im yirbu vanav, and here we go. Im yirbu vanav lemocharev. He may have a lot of kids. They're going to die by the sword. V'tzeetzav. And his descendants, lo yisbe'u lachem, they're going to die of starvation. They won't have bread. Sridav, we're in Pasuk Tedvav, sentence 15. Sridav, bamavet yikaveru. Those who remain, whoever escaped the sword and whoever escaped the famine, they're going to be buried. Ve'almanosav, lo siv kena. And their widows, or his widows, will not cry. Harsh, no? A couple of different explanations for why the widows won't cry. What would you suggest?
What did his wife say to him?
That would be dead.
His wife said, curse God and die. That was his wife's statement.
She didn't cry.
That's about him, correct.
So his sons were slain, or his daughters.
Right, but this is about them losing
the husband.
The thing is, I'm not clear on that. If you look at the text carefully, it sounds like it is his widow, but it's not. They're not going to cry over the loss of their children. Is what it sounds like.
Less mouths.
Sorry?
Less mouths.
Fewer mouths to feed, maybe. Rashi suggests is that they'll be glad their children aren't suffering anymore. They'll be put out of their misery.
Or a complete shutdown of emotions.
Shutdown of emotions, Jules suggests. Maybe it's an inability to feel at a certain point. They're just dumb to numb to everything. Shayna, and then...
I want to suggest that it's actually talking about the husbands. Yeah.
Right, so that's the question on the other side is, it says widows, so doesn't that sound like?
And if they're widows, then being married to a Rasha is good
riddance. Right. So I agree that they are widows. I mean, you can't ignore that in the Pasuk. I still think it's about the kids, but I hear what you're saying. I hear the possibility. Okay. Uh-oh. If I'm against Carla and Shana, then I'm in trouble. Maybe I really am wrong. But that mikra offers another suggestion, which is we talk about them being taken away into captivity. That's one of the themes in general about what happens to the wicked. And so he suggests maybe what's going on here is they won't cry because they're not given an opportunity to grieve. They're simply taken away. Pasuk Tetzayin, sentence 16. Im yitzbor ka'afar kesef, even if he collects silver like the dust, meaning he collects silver like you could collect dirt, just gathers it up. V'chachomer yachin malbush, and like dirt, like clay, he prepares clothes. Yachin v'tzadik yelbash, he's going to prepare it, but the righteous are going to get to wear it. V'chesef naki yachalok, and his silver, that'll be distributed by the innocent. Either the innocent will use it or the innocent will distribute it. But either way, this person is not going to get to enjoy it. The wicked person is not going to get it. If you take a look at Ralbag, I brought you in number 7. I'm coming back to 4 through 6, but take a look at number 7. Ralbag says, Ha'ish hanaki yachlok kaspo v'yifazareyu tachas asher kibetz oso harasha. Ralbag points out a nuance in the pasuk, and it's the sort of thing which you can read quickly and therefore completely miss. What was the verb used when the wicked person acquired silver? Yitzbor, right? He's going to gather it, right? He's going to collect it up. And now what's going to happen is yachlok. It'll be given out. So in other words, the wicked person said, I'm collecting it all for myself. And the response is going to be, it's all going to be divided up and scattered instead of collected as he had wished. That's what Ralbag is noting. Pasuk Yudchet, sentence 18. Bana ka'ash beso, uchesuka asa notzer. He builds like an ush his house. So an ush is a difficult term to render. Rashi renders the ush as a worm. I wondered about it as a moth of some kind. Yours renders it as a moth.
UPS does something weird. Bird's nest.
Birds? That is weird. Okay.
The house he built is like a bird's nest.
Interesting. I wonder where they got it. I haven't seen anyone who rendered ush as bird.
Or a paper uncertain. That's their notation.
Right.
So
they're
like a bird.
Yeah, okay. The truth is, I should look broader if I'm going to say it's not there, but I haven't seen it anywhere. Sorry? What would it be in modern Hebrew?
What you just said,
the moth.
The moth.
Yeah. The message is that it's a fragile home. That's what's being suggested here, is that it's something fragile. Rashi says it's a worm's hole. And the worm's hole collapses. The walls will collapse on it in the dirt. Not a wormhole, that's physics. But a worm's hole. The Da'at Mikra offers a suggestion that this ush is a creature that eats wood. And therefore it effectively destroys its own home. Hmm. It eats away at its own home. I wondered why you couldn't say it was a cocoon, which is destined for destruction. It's going to burst out and destroy it. But I haven't seen anybody make that suggestion. But it's like the sukkah asa notzer, the hut built by the guard, meaning a seasonal hut. Parenthetical note, this has a very interesting application in the Gemara in Erevin, having nothing to do with our discussion. But it gets pulled out of Eov to Erevin. Ashir yishkav velo yeasev, sentence 19. He lies down wealthy, velo yeasev. But I have news for you, he's not going to have it by the time he gets up. Einav pakach, he opens up his eyes and it is gone. By the end of his sleep, he will no longer be wealthy. It has already been taken away from him. So the message here, what we're seeing, is, as I said, what happened to Job himself. Right? What were the four destructions that happened to him in the first place? The house collapsing on his kids, and the loss of his fields and his houses and the animals, all the wealth that he had. That's what he just described here. His children are gone, and his wealth is gone. He says, that's what's going to happen to the wicked person, but he's not done. He continues, Pasuk Chav, sentence 20. Tasigehu chamayim balahos. He will be caught like water by the balahot. Balahot, we've seen it as a word several times within the book. It's a reference to some kind of demon. The demon or being of the dark. And he's going to be overtaken. I don't think it's that the overtakers are like water. I think it's that, except maybe their speed is like that of water. Like they rush upon him suddenly. Laila ginavatu sufa. At night, ginavatu, which is another one of these very odd forms that you see in Job, you see one in Ruth like this also. But at night, the storm is going to carry him away. Yisa'ehu kadim v'yelach, the east wind will pick him up and go away. V'yisa'areyu mimikomo, it will blow him from his place, sa'ara being a storm. V'yashlech alav, it will cast down on him. V'lo yachmol, it will have no mercy. Miado baroach yivrach, he will try to flee from it, or his wealth will try to flee from it. His wealth will be destroyed. Rita, what do you have?
I'm a little confused.
Excellent. Mission accomplished.
But this is everything that happened to Job.
Yeah.
And he's saying this is what's going to happen to the wicked people.
Yeah.
But he says he's righteous. So
you're not confused. That's it. That's the summary. No, that's exactly right.
That's what he's saying.
So what's the problem? Go ahead.
Well, if he's righteous, okay, but all this stuff happened to him, this is supposed to happen to the wicked.
Good.
So,
therefore, the friends.
Therefore, he must be wicked. But he's saying, "No, I'm righteous." I'm very confused here.
Excellent.
How does he?
One second. Rita is highlighting the problem. This is exactly the problem.
I thought it was me.
It's the same problem that we saw in chapter 24. He's done this before, right? In chapter 24, in mid-speech. He jumped into this sort of a speech, so much so that we said that early critics wanted to say that this was a mistake. This really was identified with Job, really belonged with one of his visitors speaking, and it's not Job at all, right? And Newsom responded, "That's just because you lack imagination." There are other ways that this can be taken. So what we're going to need to do once we reach the end of this sequence, which is in another sentence, we're going to have to come back and say, "Well, how am I meant to read this? What is Job? What is going on in this book, Carla?"
Is he not being utterly cynical and basically repeating their paradigm, how they see the world, and what would? So he's basically what is happening, obviously, to him. And then projecting it onto their worldview, and then I would expect, I would hope,
that's good.
That he would say, gotcha, because it doesn't fit, because I'm righteous.
Right. So he's not going to say gotcha. We'll have to see what we do with this, but he's not going to say gotcha, and he didn't say gotcha in chapter 24. He's done this before, and remember that we went through explanations then. We're going to have to go through them again, now. But let's read the rest of the chapter. It's one more verse. Yispok alemo kapemo, v'yisrok alav mimik, v'yisrok alav mimikomo. This is a very hard sentence to render. Yishrok is a term used for whistling, usually. It's to shriek or to wail or to whistle. Shriek, actually. Yishrok and shriek. That's pretty good. But who is clapping his hands? So the way that the Art Scroll translates it here is people from his place will clap their hands over him and whistle over him. And they have a little footnote here. Gestures of astonishment over great destruction. And that's one way that you could read the sentence, certainly. Rashi reads it that way. Ibn Ezra reads it that way. Mitzvah David reads it that way. The alternative approach is to say that the general wicked people are going to see this and think, oh no, it's coming for me next. So that will be the fear that's present here. But what is going on? Is he adopting their narrative? What has he stopped saying that he's a good guy? How do we understand this? This is very, very difficult. The classic commentaries on this read it as though it's what Job believes. In other words, they just read it as straight sentences, they explain it as straight sentences, Rashi, they just read it straight, and it's very, very difficult. Because, again, he has rejected this approach all along. Every time they said wicked people suffer, he said, no, they don't. And he brought examples. He said, I've seen wicked people who do very well, and I've seen righteous people who suffer. Another approach that was offered was to say that he's being sarcastic. He doesn't really believe it. He's just sort of giving them back, oh, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say dot, 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 dot. But it's very, very difficult to read here. It doesn't sound sarcastic at all. It doesn't have any gotcha statement at the end. It isn't introduced with what I would expect to see in an introduction. So that's very hard to see. So I offer you three approaches. One approach is the approach that I brought you last time when he did this in chapter 24, which is maybe he actually has changed his mind to a limited extent. Not in terms of his own position. He still believes I am good and God has to answer for what's happening to me. But maybe he really has come around to the idea that bad people will suffer also, and he's acknowledging that. The weakness in my saying this is that, number one, we don't have a catalyst for it. It's not as though someone said something and he said, you know, you're right. We didn't see that turnaround. And you really should. If you're making a change of this magnitude in your position, it should be signaled by something. So that's the weakness that I see in that approach. It would be consistent with what he said in 24. Now he's saying it in 27. It'll even work with the end of chapter 28. But it's hard to say because, again, we're missing a signal for it. But that's one possibility. Second possibility, if you take a look at source number 4, is Dat Mikra's approach, which is the same approach they took back in chapter 24, and I read it here by mistake in the beginning of the class. And now it'll actually make sense. Hosif ledaber aleihem besignonam shelahem. He continues speaking with them in their style. Meaning, the same way they said, wicked people have this happen, wicked people have this happen, wicked people have this. So he's going to talk to them that way, but as a threat to them. Not, wicked people suffer and that's why I suffer, but wicked people suffer and therefore you're going to suffer, he says. He threatens them. With all of the suffering that was supposed to happen to the wicked, he says, yeah, that's what's happening for you. With the same language that the visitors used when they made their declaration. So Dat Mikra's approach is to say, he isn't saying all wicked people suffer. He's saying those things that you said wicked people have, that's you. That's what he's saying. Rita, you were going to say?
Well, I don't know. Could Job also have changed his mind and said, you know, righteous people suffer too?
So that was what I had suggested. My problem is just that there's no signal for it in the book. There is no point where Job says, you know, you're right. And I would have liked to have seen that, as opposed to just making a statement in a vacuum without any sort of note of concession. Yeah. It's possible. It's possible. I just feel like it's so significant that the book wouldn't have left it just like that. I have a hard time. Even, you know, I like it. It's my idea, but I have a hard time with it.
But I just also want to know, like, is Job saying, righteous people do not suffer?
Definitely not. He has said from the start that righteous people do suffer, and he's angry about it. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the disorder that he sees in the world,
okay.
Whether because God isn't watching or whether because God is deliberately doing bad things.
So, yeah.
Shana.
The problem I have with the straight reading of this is that we just heard him say, I'm steadfast in my righteousness.
Yeah. That's
I know I don't deserve any of this.
Yeah.
So if you want to set up a scheme in which there's justice in the universe, I'm not buying into it yet.
So therefore, why is he now saying wicked people suffer?
Right. That's why I can't agree with this very reason.
Yeah, I hear it. I definitely hear it. Carla.
Is Chav Gimel not sort of like his slamming it back to his so-called friends?
Yeah, but it's not. I mean, in other words, that would support the Dat Mikra idea that he's saying this is going to happen to you. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think if you wanted to read it that way, it's a possibility.
This is what happens to bad people.
Right, and now I'm going to turn it around and so forth. Could be. I mean, there are other elements in Chav Gimel also. I'm not sure I would see it as a straight read from one into the next. But Especially given the beginning of Chavdalid, where he asks, why doesn't God punish the wicked? But Newsom, again, like she did with chapter 24, says, this is Job being difficult. This is, he wants them to live the contradiction that he is living. So it isn't enough that he says to them, outside of himself, bad people thrive, good people suffer, but he is going to speak in contradictions. So take a look at what I brought from her in source number 5. No wonder the friends have nothing else to say. Right? They're stuck after 24. They didn't have anything to say anymore. They speak a language of sanity in a presumptively sane world. Job speaks a language bordering on madness in a world turned upside down. Job's language, however, has the quality of a dare or a provocation. He has mastered one of the possible languages of subversive resistance in a totalitarian world. When the one whose existence contradicts the dominant ideology that he nevertheless speaks, right? My existence, Job is speaking, right? My experience is the opposite of the dominant ideology, and yet I am going to parrot the dominant ideology while his body silently witnesses to the truth, because everyone can see the terrible things that are happening to him. He lays out the scandal for all to see. When the person who is suffering inappropriately is speaking words that say people don't suffer inappropriately, he's like an art exhibit, in a sense.
It's a soliloquy. That's what it is. He's center stage. Everybody else is way in the dark.
Right.
And then after the soliloquy comes the exposition.
Well, if it were, right.
But that's what it's like. It's as if the act opens and there he is.
Right. I hear that. I very much hear that. So that's the way that she reads what Job is doing. You bet it's confusing. That's his goal. His goal is to force them to confront the contradiction that he sees in his life.
And he himself
is confused too. Well, confused is not quite the word. He has identified the contradiction. He wants answers, and he's angry that he doesn't have answers. So I suppose you could say that he's confused. He's because I'm in the dark. I don't know. Yeah. And he embraces the conflict. He seems very comfortable with the conflict. But yes. Yeah, Shana.
Well, in a way, he's claiming his dehumanization. You want me to be an exhibit in your argument? Well, here I am, an exhibit. Make sense of me.
Yeah. Yes, essentially. He is presenting their point of view. He is speaking their point of view, which makes no sense coming out of his mouth. That's right. That's the way Newsom reads it. I have to say, it's a fun read. I don't know if it's right, but it's a fun read. But that leads us to chapter 28. Now, 28... is a hard chapter, not in the sense of the words or the content. As word and content go, it's actually, you know, relatively straightforward. The problem is that it doesn't belong in the book. It just doesn't seem to fit. And so what we have to figure out is, why is this here? What got here? So let me explain a little bit about what we're going to see in the chapter, present the views of what it's doing here before we actually read the text. I thought about putting it in at the end, but it's so befuddling to read this without knowing what's going on that I decided to do it the other way. I hope that that's right. The chapter's theme is the search for wisdom. That's what this chapter is about. The core message that we're going to see... Yeah, I'm going to put it on the middle.